Look, it's carbon, you know, doing anything on this scale is obviously produces a lot of carbon emissions. But the real problem is that it underwrites the constant efforts of the fossil fuel machine, the day in, day out production of fossil fuel. That's what we have a chance here to knock off its pedestal. This is a moment that we should seize in all seriousness in order to take on the two huge existential plagues that face us this morning: the climate crisis outlined in this new IPCC report, and the fact that we have a madman with nuclear weapons who's used the revenues from oil and gas to intimidate and terrify the entire world.
Bill McKibben, I want to thank you for being with us, author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. We'll link to your pieces. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, all.
This is KBOO Portland.
What would KBOO be without its more than 300 volunteers? They support the station with everything, and now they need someone to support them. KBOO is looking for a community organizer who would bolster and empower our volunteers. Are you the right person, or do you know someone who is? Then go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the volunteer coordinator and the qualifications we're looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, March 6 at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Remember, KBOO is a volunteer-powered radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon will drop its mask mandate on March 12th, a week earlier than previously expected. Civil rights groups are calling for an investigation into police misinformation following the February 19th mass shooting in Northeast Portland. And in international news, Ukraine pushes for a ceasefire as fighting continues and sanctions hit Russia's economy. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 28th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon Governor Kate Brown said on Monday that the state will drop its indoor mask mandate on March 12th. That's a week earlier than previously announced. The governor said that Oregon, California, and Washington State would lift their mask mandates simultaneously at 11:59 p.m. on March 11th. The order will affect more than 51.2 million people across the West Coast, or about 15% of the U.S. population. The announcement is the third time in the past month that Oregon has revised its plans for lifting masking requirements while indoors. The state had previously planned to lift its masking requirements at the end of March and moved those plans up to March 19th last week. Now the state will drop its indoor mask mandate on March 12th. The Oregon Health Authority said the lifting of the mask mandate did not include changes to federal and state rules on masks in healthcare facilities, airline flights, public transit, and other specialized settings. The new date does not include ending mask mandates in schools. Governor Kate Brown said in a statement, quote, "As has been made clear time and again over the last 2 years, COVID-19 does not stop at state borders or county lines. On the West Coast, our communities and economies are linked. Together, as we continue to recover from the Omicron surge, we will build resiliency and prepare for the next variant and the next pandemic." Racial justice groups in Portland met Friday to decry city leadership's response to the mass shooting on February 19th, which targeted Black Lives Matter and anti-fascist activists. At around 8 p.m. on February 19th, a man named Ben Smith, who lived in an apartment complex near Normandale Park in Northeast Portland, angrily approached a group of unarmed protesters who had gathered at the park to support a demonstration against police killings. Smith allegedly shot 5 people, killing one. He only stopped shooting when another individual in the crowd allegedly shot him in the hip. During a virtual press conference hosted by Don't Shoot Portland and Race Talks, community leaders accused the city of spreading disinformation shortly after the shooting took place, which emboldened right-wing groups. The initial narrative from the Portland Police Bureau was that the incident was a, quote, confrontation between an armed homeowner and armed protesters. Right-wing activists online immediately spread this statement, jumping to the conclusion that left-wing protesters had attacked the man on his property. The statement was also shared by local and national media outlets. Neither PPB nor Police Commissioner Mayor Ted Wheeler have retracted that narrative or apologized for the misinformation it spread. Portland Police Bureau Chief Chuck Lavelle was asked why Portland Police identified Smith as a homeowner during a Tuesday press conference, to which Chief Lavelle said he, quote, didn't know. PPB has also accused people who witnessed the shooting of refusing to speak to officers. Sandy Chung is the director of ACLU Oregon. Chung said that only shows a deficiency in law enforcement's ability to do their job. On Friday, racial justice leaders called for an investigation into how PPB communicates information after a high-interest crime takes place. Bobin Singh, the director of Oregon Justice Resource Center, said at the virtual meeting, quote, "It's important for city leadership to really reflect on the false demonization of protesters, Black Lives Matter movement individuals, and communities of color over the years, and how that has led to these conditions." The Oregon Department of Justice announced Friday that an investigation into Portland Police Detective Eric Kammerer has found insufficient evidence to bring criminal charges. Kammerer was also known as Officer 67 of the Rapid Response Team. He was investigated following multiple allegations that he used excessive force against protesters and at least one bystander during protests in 2020. In a February 24th letter addressed to the Multnomah County DA, Senior Assistant Attorney General Jamie Kimberly outlined four instances the Department of Justice investigated for potential criminal charges. One of the cases the DOJ investigated happened on September 5, 2020, an incident in which Elijah Warren, a Portland father and homeowner, alleged that Kammerer struck him in the back of the head with a baton as he informed other officers outside his home that tear gas had seeped into the house, affecting his 13-year-old son and his son's friend. In another incident, the DOJ found insufficient evidence to corroborate the allegation that, during two separate protests in June 2020, Kammerer shoved independent journalists to the ground. The investigators considered three possible charges: harassment, fourth-degree assault, and first-degree official misconduct. They found insufficient evidence, so Kammerer does not face any criminal charges. Courts in North Carolina have wide discretion on when to release the footage of police-worn body cameras. Critics say the state's current policies for determining the public release of law enforcement-worn body cameras is obscure and often results in drastically different outcomes. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story.
Under a 2016 law, footage from cameras worn by North Carolina police officers can only be released through court order. But critics say the process the courts use to determine whether footage should be released is discretionary and often results in drastically different outcomes. Groups such as Emancipate NC say the problem is highlighted by the recent decisions of a Superior Court judge to deny an application for general release of footage during a 2020 no-knock raid, while approving the release of body camera footage of the shooting of Daniel Tercios by Raleigh police. North Carolina civil rights attorney Abraham Rupert Schul explains the current statute gives judges wide discretion.
Part of the complexity is that courts across the state and court systems across the state have very different procedural mechanisms for how they handle body camera petitions and release of footage in general.
Last fall, state lawmakers passed legislation that bars law enforcement agencies from sharing body camera footage with family members, who now must petition a court for access to footage. Schul says the threshold of whether the recorded scene is a critical incident is often used to rule against releasing footage. He points out that a critical incident typically means someone was seriously injured, died, or was shot, but notes it's not a requirement of the state's body camera release statute.
I think it's important for the public to know that There is no critical incident standard written into the statute. That is not part of the statute. That is a standard that the city or law enforcement has put into place.
Shule says access to body camera footage is critical for the public to be able to weigh in on what types of police actions are considered acceptable. He adds that most people have a limited understanding of how police operate in certain cases.
An example of this is no-knock raids or raids of people's homes. This occurs somewhat frequently in North Carolina, and I think that the public really has very little to no conception of this or how it works unless it's actually happened to you.
According to federal data, nearly half of police departments in the country use body-worn cameras. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
The ACLU of Arkansas argues that the state house map weakens black voting power throughout the state. It's appealing a federal judge's decision to dismiss that case. Emily Scott has more.
The ACLU of Arkansas is appealing the decision by a federal judge who dismissed a challenge to a new state house map, saying the plan hurts black voters and violates the Voting Rights Act. In a ruling earlier this month, a U.S. district judge wrote that private individuals do not have the right to sue under the Voting Rights Act, and that only the U.S. Attorney General may bring a case under the statute. Gary Sullivan of the ACLU of Arkansas says that in 50-plus years of the law, no federal judge has ever made that kind of ruling. He says until there's an appeal decision, the map will be in place, including for the upcoming May primary.
Until that happens, the effect is that the black voters in Arkansas have had their vote diluted, and it will be hard, if not impossible, for black voters to elect candidates of choice, which is required by Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
The U.S. Department of Justice has declined to intervene in the case. The suit was filed on behalf of the Arkansas State Conference NAACP and the Arkansas Public Policy Panel. In a statement, Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, who was named in the suit for her role on the Board of Apportionment, said she's pleased Arkansans can confidently move forward with the election process. The lawsuit alleges the map unnecessarily splits black communities living in the Upper Delta, Lower Delta, and Central and Southwest Arkansas. Barry Jefferson of the Arkansas State Conference NAACP says the House voting map does not accurately reflect the black population in Arkansas, which grew by an estimated 30,000 people, according to U.S. Census data.
We saw where we should be increasing in our representation of districts in our state, and it didn't show it. So we had to file a lawsuit because we had to represent the people in our membership and people who felt that was unjust.
Of the 100 House districts, 11 are considered black majority voting districts. But the ACLU argues that 16 districts would be more reflective of the state's demographics. The case now goes to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis, where a decision is likely in 8 to 12 months. I'm Emily Scott with Arkansas News Service.
Fighting continued around key cities in Ukraine on Monday as the country's first talks with Russia since last week's invasion ended with no immediate breakthrough. Ukrainian and Russian officials sat down for talks on the Belarus border. Moscow said officials negotiating at the border had, quote, heard each other. Ukraine said its second largest city, Kharkiv, was coming under heavy attacks from massive Russian shelling as staunch resistance is hampering Russia's advance. Ukraine's position has been bolstered by military assistance from countries around the world and a growing sanctions effort that has affected Russia's economy. The U.S. has expanded sanctions on Russia's central bank, while the country of Switzerland, breaking its traditionally neutral status, has announced sanctions as well. The U.S. also said it will expel 12 Russian intelligence operatives from the Russian mission to the United Nations. Russia's military reported its nuclear deterrent forces have been put on high alert following Putin's order. The International Criminal Court will open a probe into possible war crimes in Ukraine as the UN said Monday that 102 civilians, including 7 children, have been killed across Ukraine since Thursday. They added that those figures probably undercount the full extent of the national death toll. Meanwhile, the head of the UN Refugee Agency said that more than 500,000 people had fled the country in the wake of the Russian attack. Ukraine sought to tighten its bond with the West on Monday, formally applying to join the European Union. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky posted photos of himself signing the application and appealed to the EU to, quote, accept Ukraine immediately. With the Russian invasion of Ukraine underway, groups in New York are urging the United States to take swift action to accept as many Ukrainian refugees as possible and protect Ukrainians without legal status from deportation. Lily Bolke has the story.
The New York Immigration Coalition is among the groups urging the U.S. to take in as many Ukrainian refugees as possible as Ukraine faces an ongoing invasion by Russia. New York has roughly 150,000 Ukrainian residents, the largest population in the nation. Governor Kathy Hochul has said New York is prepared to coordinate with the Biden administration to accept refugees fleeing the conflict. Nicole Kata with the New York Immigration Coalition hopes to see resources directed to beefing up the refugee program.
It's an absolutely devastating week for Ukrainians both at home and abroad. And our strongest message is that the NYIC will always stand with those seeking a safe haven from violence and war. And we're urging the United States to take as many refugees in as possible.
Kata says the U.S. needs to strengthen and rebuild its refugee program after the former Trump administration gutted it. The former president halted the program multiple times and set the ceiling for admitting refugees lower than ever. More than 100 recipients of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and more than 1,700 international students are from Ukraine. Kata hopes the Biden administration will put measures into place protecting them from deportation.
We're calling for an immediate designation of temporary protected status or deferred enforced departure or special student relief for the tens of thousands of Ukrainians who are in the United States already and without a permanent status in the U.S.
Special student relief refers to a Homeland Security program that removes visa restrictions for students, such as duration of stay and ability to work off campus when emergent circumstances occur, such as war or military conflict. This is Lily Bolke with New York News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. This episode features Chief Scientist at Wild Heritage, Dr. Dominic Della Sala, speaking about the Tongass Rainforest and U.S. Strategic Natural Carbon Reserve. Stick around at 6, we'll hear Labor Radio, then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow that rain continues with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1953, Cambridge University scientists James Watson and Francis Crick announced that they have determined the double helix structure of DNA, the molecule containing human genes. The molecular biologists were aided significantly by the work of another DNA researcher, Rosalind Franklin, although she is not included in the announcement, nor did she share their subsequent Nobel Prize award. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist and retired nurse aide Claudette Colvin, who said, quote, "I knew then and I know now when it comes to justice, there is no easy way to get it." Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will begin the confirmation process in the Senate this week with meetings from leaders from both parties. President Biden announced Jackson as his historic nominee to the High Court on Friday. She will meet with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Wednesday and later meet with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin, and Senator Chuck Grassley, the panel's top GOP member. Jackson will replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer if confirmed by the Senate and would make history as the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court. Currently, Jackson is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. She's also served on the Federal District Court in Washington and as vice chair of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. If her nomination is approved by the 50-50 Senate, she'll be the first justice in decades to have experience representing criminal defendants, as Jackson is a former federal public defender. Jackson's nomination received widespread praise from Democrats and progressive organizations, while Republicans vowed to conduct a careful review of her record. three Republican senators, Suzanne Collins of Maine, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, voted to confirm Jackson to the D.C. Circuit in June 2021, though they haven't yet said whether they would support her bid for the Supreme Court. With Democrats holding a narrow majority in the Senate, as Vice President Kamala Harris cast tie-breaking votes, Jackson does not need Republican support to win approval by the upper chamber if all 50 Democrats agree with her confirmation. The Supreme Court agreed today to hear a case challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. That act states it is U.S. policy to protect the best interests of Native American children and to promote the stability and security of Native American tribes and families by establishing minimum federal standards for the removal of Native Americans from their homes and requiring placement of children in foster or adoptive homes which will reflect the unique values of Native American culture. Before that law was passed, literally hundreds of thousands of Native American children were taken away, sometimes by force, and placed in institutions or with families with no ties to their tribes. Three states, Texas, Louisiana, and Indiana, and seven people sued the federal government to challenge the law, stating that it's an intrusion into matters traditionally governed by state law. The plaintiffs also suggest it's a violation of equal protection principles because it's based on race. Several tribes, including the Cherokee and the Navajo, have defended the law. They called the state's race discrimination argument inflammatory. The 1978 law, they suggest, is tied to membership in a tribe. Thus, it's about politics, not race. They say the law has been effective to date, but that Native American children remain more likely to be removed from their homes than other children. Texas says that is a result of societal conditions. The state said high numbers of adoptions and fostering of quote-unquote Indian children are a sign of the high risk of neglect, violence, gang activity, drug abuse, alcoholism, and suicide among those children. The challengers mostly prevailed before a federal trial court in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. The full Fifth Circuit reheard the case and issued a divided decision that caused both sides to seek a Supreme Court review. The Supreme Court will hear arguments in its next term, which begins in October. Legal scholars say that if the rationale for striking down the law survives, it could also threaten laws that guard tribal casinos and water and land rights. The Kansas Education Commissioner is suspended for an offensive joke about Native Americans, and indigenous groups celebrate the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Kansas tribes are seeking the removal of the state's education commissioner, Randy Watson, following disparaging comments Watson made at a recent conference. The education official recounted a childhood story about tornadoes, saying he would tell his cousins to be more worried about Indians raiding a town. Last week, the Kansas Department of Education released a video of Watson making the remarks during a virtual gathering.
Yeah, it's always fascinating. I had some cousins in California. They were petrified of tornadoes. They'd come visit us, you know, in the summer. They're like, are we going to get killed by a tornado? And I'd say, don't worry about that. But you got to worry about the Indians raiding the town at any time. And they really thought that, you know, grew up in California. I guess you don't know much of the history of Kansas.
The four tribes of Kansas are asking for Watson's resignation and say they refuse to consider any other alternatives. The tribes say there are deeper concerns about the safety and welfare of Native students attending Kansas schools. They want children to be proud of being Native American and being able to celebrate their culture in an environment which displays respect and honor. The tribes say Native people continue to flourish even when faced with incidents like this one with the commissioner of the Kansas school system. Watson was reportedly talking about difficulties teaching during the pandemic and used hurricanes and tornadoes as an example when he told the story. The Kansas City Star reports Watson offered his resignation last week, but it was rejected by the Board of Education. Instead, he was suspended without pay for 30 days. The National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund released a joint statement Friday on President Biden's nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court. If confirmed, she'll be the first Black woman to sit on the highest court in the nation. National Congress of American Indians President Fawn Sharp in a statement said, Indian country knows how important it is to have diverse perspectives and voices on the bench. Sharp called on the Senate to fulfill its duties and hold hearings on the nomination. Native American Rights Fund Executive Director John Echohawk said they look forward to working with NCAI on the nomination. The national Native organizations closely follow what happens in federal courts and work to increase knowledge of federal Indian law, as decisions often have impacts on tribal nations. The group stressed the need for Supreme Court justices to have the understanding, recognizing, and upholding principles of tribal sovereignty, treaty rights, and federal trust responsibilities. Healthcare for tribal citizens living in Pennington County, South Dakota, is now controlled by tribes and not the federal government. On Saturday, all healthcare services provided by the Indian Health Service Rapid City Unit transferred to the Oyate Health Center. The center is a tribally managed clinic operated by the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board. The Cheyenne River Sioux, Rosebud Sioux, and Oglala Sioux tribes formally authorized the change. The center provides a range of health and wellness services to American Indian and Alaska Native people. Patients who require care beyond the capabilities of the unit will be referred to outside providers. Emergency services will be transferred to a hospital about 4 miles away. According to the Indian Health Service, more than 60% of IHS appropriation is administered by tribes, primarily through self-determination contracts or self-governance compacts. IHS provides health care to more than 2 million American Indians and Alaska Natives across the country. The United National Indian Tribal Youth Organization is mourning the loss of its founder, J.R. Cook, who passed away Friday at the age of 83 in Oklahoma. Cook started the organization in the 1970s with a small group of people. Unity has since grown, representing Native youth leaders across the U.S. and internationally, fostering their spiritual, mental, physical, and social development. Cook's death comes as Unity wrapped up its mid-year gathering over the weekend in Arizona, where hundreds of young people took part in Native youth-led activities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Russia puts its nuclear forces on high alert. The UN plans a historic rebuke of Russia, and Trump emerges as CPAC's presidential frontrunner. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We will fight as long as it takes to liberate the country. If children are born in shelters, even when the shelling continues, then the enemy has no chance in this undoubtedly people's war.
Speaking through a translator, Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky defied what he called brutal Russia's attacks. But he also said they'll give long-shot peace talks at the Belarus border a chance. At least 350 civilians in Ukraine have been killed since the invasion began Thursday. As of last night, stiff Ukrainian resistance had repeatedly repelled Russian attempts to take the capital, Kiev, and other large cities amid intense shelling and rocket attacks. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered his country's nuclear forces on high alert following what he called aggressive statements by NATO countries. The UN will hold an emergency session today that could allow for all 139 members to call for Russia's immediate withdrawal. It'll only be the 11th such meeting since 1950. Meanwhile, Ukraine asked the International Criminal Court in The Hague to impose reparations on Russia, accusing Moscow of planning genocide. Around the world, protests in support of Ukraine were held, including in Washington, D.C. Reports say more than 2,000 anti-war protesters have been arrested in Russia. Those charged could face heavy fines and jail time for protesting without a permit. Members of Congress are back in Washington this week, signaling bipartisan support of economic aid for Ukraine. Chair of the Senate Ukraine Caucus, Rob Portman of Ohio, told Cleveland rallygoers he'll meet with the Ukrainian ambassador to the UN today.
We're going to talk about the humanitarian aid that's needed to help to combat these cyber attacks, because this war has been going on for 8 years. To combat the disinformation that is flooding into Ukraine every single day. To ensure that we are tightening these sanctions.
Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee believes additional sanctions are also needed.
Putin has called this an operation, but it is not an operation. And all of the NATO allies who are freedom-loving, they have acknowledged that this is sheer brutality.
The Biden administration is expected to ask Congress for $6 billion in economic and military aid. Former President Donald Trump used his speech at this weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida as an opportunity to claim that the Russian invasion would never have occurred under his watch.
The problem is not that Putin is smart, which of course he's smart, but the real problem is that our leaders are dumb. Putin is playing Biden like a drum.
Trump teased a 2024 presidential run and later emerged as the clear winner in the conference's straw poll. Nearly 60% of those asked support Trump as the GOP nominee, while 28% support Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 28th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Tin Can Phone. At 11, it's Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Sarah Kate Nomura about her show, Fashion and Fantasy, the Art of Netsuke Carvings, on now at the Portland Japanese Garden. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Hey everybody, thank you for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. Today we are sharing with you a special presentation by Dr. Dominic De La Sala to the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance about the Tongass National Forest and natural climate solutions.
Thanks everyone so much for joining tonight. We